Hi, and welcome to Prosody, WYEP's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. I'm Renee Alberts, guest host of Prosody, and my guest tonight is the poet David Hurley. David Hurley is a technical writer, freelancer, and founder and editor of Subtlety.com, an art site that leans toward the written word. He is a Pittsburgh native and still lives here with his wife, Marsha, who is soon to give birth to their daughter, Kara Zeal. His first book, Abyssinia, Jill Rush, has recently been published by Time Being Books. Hi, David. Thank you for being here today.
Oh, glad to be here.
Looking forward to hearing some work from your new book. Do you want to start us off?
Sure. I'll start off with a poem about time. Imagine a poet writing about time. E.E. Cummings' best line is time, 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 time. This is a little peek into my obsession with time. Hamlet said that time is out of joint. Up ahead is down the road, and the road goes back into the future. Yes, the future follows us. We don't trail behind it, don't live into it. With our sneaky language, we stretch and fold time like gum. We speak of the following weeks, said Umberto Eco. Time follows us, is behind, not in front. Hamlet said that time is out of joint. No, bipolar Dane, the rapid single moment has you trapped between the nunnery and a good lay, between avenging Daddy King and graveyard worms. Well, blame it on time, said Garbo. Time, bloody time. I knew them once, all the roles in my dramas cast. They breathe and live forever. They are not ghosts. I'm compelled to hybridize Miller and Douglas. Time keeps on slipping, slipping, slipping into the ever-living now. This next one is called I Kiss Her Over and Over Forever, and it's sort of a chant, an invocation of high school David and today David, blurring the past and present. Here, then, I'm here and then, was there and am, was is, then was here when I was then. She had a cold, but I still kiss her. She has a cold, but I still kissed her. You are David, she said. You were David, she says. She wore white gloves. She wears white gloves. Then, here, the past stays. There is no isn't. I like appropriating terms, making them my own. I guess that's what poetry is. And I became fascinated with the theory that Vermeer used a camera obscura to do his work, and David Hockney's theory that some of the great painters used a camera lucida to do their work. And I love the sounds of those terms, lucida, obscura. I realize there are metaphors for my gloom and the salvation that Mary Poppins embodies. Mary Poppins breaks my little heart. Descend, wind changer, spoon medicine into this sick man. You, the camera lucida, me, the camera obscura. Carry eternity in your bag. Blow away old age. Your smile on my umbilicus. My heart wakes like an umbrella. I was born here, obscura. You came here, lucida. This next poem is called My Face is a Koan. I love koans. They're frustrating. They're meant to spark and kill thought. They mock our sensibilities. And I thought, my face is sort of a koan. It's a mystery I face in the mirror every day. I can't figure it out. And I guess you could say this poem's about how I have a face for radio. My face doesn't match my face. I mean my true face on the flip side. Inside, I'm a 00 agent, Brando, Philip Marlowe, Paul Newman. Not Columbo, Chuck Lawton, Laurie. When I dare, the mirror of divergence shocks me. That's not a reflection. It's an imposter, a bizarro version, a reverse Dorian Gray portrait. I pity that warped rendition for its failure to portray my true face. There is white noise between who I am and how I look, the face that's worn, and the face from before I was born. But how have I been able to charm some women? Because I've dated only superhero chicks with X-ray vision. How do I know my true face? Like this. And that was a little nod to Lao Tzu, The original lines were, "How do I know the world like this?" As much as I hate the idea of monarchy, what the Jacobins did to Marie Antoinette and the royal family is inexcusable. In the name of liberty and fraternity, they fed heads to what they called Saint Guillotine. And that's why I don't put my faith in programs or reforms. Plus, I'm very ambivalent. I'm rated X for ambivalence. And you'll see why. Pendulum. I swing from Thomas Paine to Edmund Burke, from Burke to Paine. I'm a morning Antony and an evening Cicero, an armchair Nietzsche and a fair-weather Socrates. When a cause trumpets, I long for silence. When the frivolous reigns, I want manifestos. I sway from Adam to mob, mob to Adam. I'm pendulous between the anarch and the monarch. But then, the monarch is the anarch. The anarch is the monarch. The pig is the man. The man is the pig. I cut through man and pig.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Renee Alberts, guest host of Prosody, and my guest tonight is the poet David Hurley, reading from his new book, Abyssinia, Jill Rush. So something that is immediately striking to me about your work is that, which is apparent from the introductions that you're giving us to your poems as well, is this very personal relationship to literary figures and historical events and historical figures.
Indeed.
Can you talk about that?
Yeah. I always talk about contextuality. These writers, philosophers, celebrities, artists are in me, with me at all times. I consider them to be the ingredients of who I am.
I think that that comes through in your work because it's clear that you have this investment with being inspired by these other characters like Hamlet, but also it sort of seems to come across this line past influence or inspiration, and these people become almost characters in your work. And you have a line in the poem, Hamlet says, "Time is out of joint," that says something about ghosts from your dramas. And I wondered in that line, my initial reading was that those ghosts were these figures that you allude to from history and from literature sort of appearing in your poetry. But when you read it just now, I wondered too if those had maybe been people that you knew in your life as well. And I think...
Both. So these fictional characters are more real than real people in some cases. I always say that cigar smoke is Orson Welles. the moon or the snow is Garbo's skin.
Let's hear some more poems.
This next one is called "How Carefree, How Lonely," says Issa. I want to be Garbo alone, in Edward Hopper's solitude, insular as Eric Hoffer at a soccer stampede, or Pascal on the doorstep of the silent infinite spaces, divergent as the second century's Lenny Bruce Lucian before a throng of thonged, chattering courtesans, a blizzard-obscured beacon, an untasted nipple, a pause between music, emptyful. Guns and Butter. This next one is inspired by the savage in Huxley's Brave New World. He was a round peg trying to fit into a square hole, or the other way around. And in Brave New World, books such as the Bible and Shakespeare were banned because they made people sad. But the savage insisted that tears are necessary. That you don't take into account the whole human if you cut out the bad. He said that, "I don't want comfort. I want God. I want poetry. I want real danger. I want freedom. I want goodness. I want sin." Guns and Butter. Life is crisis, white water rapids, teeth bitten through tongues, poems that leave sucker bites, swear words from pure mouths. Give me anguish, not a happy march. Give me outrage, not the in crowd. Balance my crib on the precipice. I claim the right to be unhappy. I'm Huxley's savage. I'm a joyful misery. I'm a life. This next one's a little longer. Powdered Water. Fascist collectivists deconstruct Sophia, damn I am. Passion without telos is a sustained note without notation, a forest of trees falling unheard, a lock on a door to nowhere, a boot stomping on a human face forever. Logical positivist reductio ad infinitum is an Escher hand drawing and erasing itself. The cosmic plaything chants the axiom that there are no axioms. Bentham turns Pushkin into a game of pushpin. If it's all just about, then it's all about nothing, the sound of one hand not clapping. If it's all a means to a means, then it's a prison run by prisoners, fish not knowing they're wet, batteries run by batteries, an infinite definition of definition, transvaluation of transvaluation, powdered water, just add water. The ultimate anti-Stratfordian theory, Othello, was composed by an infinitely typing monkey. Desdemona earned him a brown banana. I swear that Sweet Jane means sui generis, and the abysmal underground is truly velvet. The velvet fog croons, there's a song in my heart. Bergman, do you deny the heart in the song? Brother, can you spare a damn? Sister, can you feel the absence of absence in the human kiss? De Man, Foucault, Calvin, Comte, Dr. Ruth, Dr. Seuss. As Burgess says, every dogma has its day. Might right bogues volley for victory like Guy Gametes for Ova. But whence the song? Whence the heart? Whence the face before the boot? Time plus chance plus time plus chance plus time plus chance. These things don't compute from time plus chance. I like my poems to sound and look beautiful. I don't want them to be Gertrude Stein. I want them to be Katy Perry. also, I tend to focus on human-centric subjects. I don't like nature poems, nature on its own. Blake said that where man is not, nature is barren. Or give me death. Give me engorged purple prose, high yellow journalism, courtly love over proper matrimony, lies that lie to themselves and produce soft truths, empty tombs over crucifix fixation, Revlon over Friedan, spun and doctored faces. Give me mood lighting, tic-tacs before kisses, wild over Zala. Killer Gina. This is an orgy of references. Debussy, Kierkegaard, Myrna Loy, Baudelaire, Shelley. Gina, killer Gina. Gina, killer Gina. Mistress of the mighty drink, la mer, the silver deeps. Let down your hair, killer Gina, and I'll climb the mingled milky locks, the foamy decidua tresses, my moon alloy. Gina, killer Gina. Gina, killer Gina. Rosh Hashanah de Silentio. Baudelaire, shell-borne gun mall. Fallopia de Milo, bonny ocean, show the bitter butter, the lava membrane, and dewy expectation. Carnivorous Queen Mab, my airy Anne, my ebony Bam, my boo. On my knees in the sand, I watch a pink kite spasm in the wind. Lemon Hill. He and I were kings of suburban winter, our locomotive breath, our comfortable telepathic silences, the snow crust cracking. We held the moon's laundered sunlight in our gloved hands and drank of it in unison. Me, I drink this in remembrance. He, I drink this to never forget. My breath, his breath, the wind sighed rosemary. When hibernating trees clacked, we imagined a vampire woman spying. She'd steal the sun from us some night.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Renee Alberts, guest host of Prosody, and my guest tonight is the poet David Hurley, reading from his new book, Abyssinia, Jill Rush. Do you want to tell us a little bit more about your book? It just came out recently.
Sure.
Congratulations.
Thank you so much. I'm thrilled.
It's a terrific looking book, and I'm enjoying the poems that you're reading from it. So with your poems, there's this sense of, I get a sense of being almost inside the mind of the speaker and feeling pulled through these wanderings and decisions and then re-wanderings that he makes and then sort of released again. sort of this dynamic swirling of thoughts and then coming out of the poem and feeling like you've just experienced this very definite voice. And you mentioned before how these historical and literary characters sort of blend with your people who you've known in more traditional ways as being equally real to you. And I wonder if maybe part of the strength of that persona comes from the sense of history and literature sort of converging in this speaker, and the speaker identifying all of these figures is what makes them important. But I wonder, I mean, in this last poem, Lemon Hill, that you just read, there's also a sense of more of a sense of narrative and sort of philosophizing that a lot of the other poems in the book have. And I'm curious how you work with the idea of persona.
Well, the last poem was actual. That actually happened. That's biographical. The other poems you're talking about, I sort of spill out erudition, and there's a danger in that. You can be too erudite. It's both a freedom and a slavery. You can look into the mind of the, or into the eyes of a brute and see very little there, but you can look into the eyes of a brutal intellect and there's nothing there. So I like to flaunt what I know, but then kick it in the teeth, contradict it, and get down to what really matters. My friend and I walking on the crusty snow.
For me, that comes across in your poems. They're clearly so learned and address these intellectual, deep philosophical questions. They're saved from this sort of high-mindedness and inaccessibility by that personal investment that comes across. There's an emotional investment in these intellectual thoughts. And I think that that comes through very strongly in the voice that you write in.
Thank you. Sure. I hope I inspire folks to Google stuff.
You certainly inspired me. Let's move on to some more poems.
Okay. Oh, my. I have to apologize in advance for this next one to you folks out there that have dark eyes. Like me, I have brown eyes. But this is sort of a playful worship. This is called Zooey Deschanel's Eyes or To My Blue-Eyed Wife. She's an actress. She was in Almost Famous, I think a M. Night movie, The Happening. Van Morrison, your brown-eyed girl is too close to entropic autumn, to food, to soil. I've shala license to say so because I myself am a mud-eyed ghoul. But Zooey Deschanel's eyes are rated X on the spectrum between gamma and ultraviolet. They bloom awake after the long blind night, two landless earths seen from space, like Julie Christie, Bethlehemic is Vivian Leigh's violet birth among Darjeelings. Zooey shoots blue Tesla lightning through okra camouflage, Lilithian melanin. My own cursed browns shy downward when Zooey sings the blues after the long blind night. Here's a Google moment. You folks out there, Google Magritte's Time Transfixed. It's a train coming out of a mirror in a rather empty room. The cliche is apt. Time is a nonstop train on a track run by the tick of the clock. But Magritte, locomotive steaming on no track, coming from and going nowhere. Fireless fireplace, bare walls, and it's 12:43 on both sides of the infinite mirror. A wise man once said that there will be a time when there will be no time. There was a difference between infinity and eternity. Cleopatra saw eternity in sex. This is not a poem about time. That's a reference to Magritte's This Is Not a Pipe painting. Fortune cookies. These are leftover lines thrown together. He who throws the junk food is king of Gauls. Our very bones are music. Yuxit got in Alan Landon. Home is where the hurt is. The hells are alive with the sound of Muzak. The doors of perception are locked from the inside. You will lose it if you don't use it. Legalists hang themselves on statutory rope. The spirit has no sex. Love is a many-splintered thing. This next poem is about my father, who I who left rather violently when I was about 11 years old. This is called Davidus the Confessor's Greta Garbo Fantasy. My father beat his fists and kicked his foot against the front door while my mother ignored him and my brother slept upstairs. I crouched under the windowsill, feeling his fists and foot shake the wall and floor. He stormed away, leaving loud silence in his wake. My manly adult self left that night, banished, divorced, turned to concave stone by his own eunuch alchemy. I was penectomized, coquetted. I wanted to curl up in girl land, forego testosteronal mandates. I became the shy wallflower, the abandoned daughter tramping for a father figure, the beach waif ignored by Charles Atlas. Thanks to late-night reruns, I wanted to become Garbo's laugh, her gruff accent, her eyelashes, her wicked ways. I imagined seductress Mercedes de Acosta pounding at the door, then kicking it in, invading like wind and the salt of the sea, storming feverishly like an Amazon demon across the keys. Sometimes I think that laughter is the best medicine. Sometimes I think weeping is. T.S. Eliot said that in the end, horror and laughter may be one. So these next two poems belong together. The first one is called A Laugh is the Ultimon. I'm convinced that a laugh is the Ultimon, the irreducible particle of everything. A laugh is the base of the plenum. There is no abyss when the laugh comes. A.A. Milne trumps Euripides. Mencken said, one horse laugh is worth 1,000 syllogisms. The answer to screams and horrors is a laugh. I stride through the inferno, slosh through the blood, laughing, impervious. Laughs bloom dandelions like little yellow afros. A tear is the ultimon. No, not laughter, tears. Tears are our salvation. Tears have saved us from the tooth and nail. Oh, that's it. I've discovered the key. Weep, my brothers and sisters. Gush that sorrow, that pity, that funny, that joy. Spill the soul's blood, drown earth in tears. Anyone can laugh. Butchery is gleeful. Torture is hilarious. The devil does stand up. But watch someone cry for another's pain. Cry in atrocity. Cry in remorse and confession and fear. Adoration, awe, pleasure, martyrdom. You have seen the ultimate miracle, that we shed tears, that our hearts are full of tragedy, though comedy fills our heads. A tear is the ultimon, the irreducible particle of everything. The answer to the abyss is a tear, the crucifix pearl, the demi-urgent eye, the egg of grace.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Renee Alberts, guest host of Prosody, and my guest tonight is the poet David Hurley. Those last two poems that you read, A Laugh is the Ultimon and A Tear is the Ultimon, are two examples of several poems in your collection in which you use a similar title or a similar structure in the poems or even within poems where you state one thing and then contradict it. And I wonder whether you set out to write two approaches or two sides to an opinion, or whether you find yourself in writing changing your mind.
No, I definitely believe both. Think of how my wife feels. Like I said, I'm very ambivalent. I don't think that's a weakness. It's not wishy-washy, as some of the political pundits would say. You can't be lukewarm. I think ambivalence is agility. You're less apt to be swept away by a charlatan or a mass movement or a soul-killing dogma.
It's noticeable in the poems that there's an awareness of these movements, and there's a lot of mention of political movements, but the poems are always asking questions. So in spite of this apparent large body of knowledge that you're coming to these poems with, they're very rarely making statements. They're almost always asking questions.
It's a cliche to say it, but the more you know, the more you know you don't know. I think it's the same with a lot of things. People bashed Mother Teresa whenever they found secret writings that she had doubts. And I found that to be wonderful that we found that out about her. I think that the more you believe, the more you have to doubt. So I don't make definitive statements because I'm not there.
All right, we have time for one more poem.
All right. This is called Swimming to the Mountain. The water is alive, is a light, a dark black light. I rise and fall with the water. Rise, rise, fall, fall. Think into the surface. Think into the surface. There's a mountain in my heart. I want to climb the mountain. I want to hear the secret.
The poetry of David Hurley. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Prosody, WYEP's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. Writers appearing on Prosody also have their work showcased in Chapter and Verse, a bi-weekly feature in Pittsburgh City Paper, the Arts Entertainment News Weekly, published every Wednesday. Prosody is produced by Jan Beatty and Ellen Wadey. Our sound engineers are Michelle Stoner and Lisa Alexander. Please tune in at our new time every Wednesday night at 7:30 for Prosody, 91.3 WYEP.